radio.dominican.edu. Another Institute for Leadership Studies lecture, part of the lecture series here at DU at Dominican University of California. Tonight, Dr. Luann Brizendine is in the house, part of the lecture series. Also coming up, Bill McKibben on April 22nd, Craig Robinson on April 27th, and Michael Chabon on April 28th. That's the One Book, One Marin night here at Dominican University of California. Tonight, Luann Brizendine, The Male Brain. She is the author of The Male Brain, also of The Female Brain. Tonight, though, her new release, The Male Brain, she will be talking about. The house is loaded. Lots of people here tonight. And we're really looking forward to a great lecture. Just about 3 minutes from now, we'll have it for you live, worldwide, on radio.dominican.edu.
Hi, everyone. I am so excited to see you all here tonight. I'm Elaine Petricelli from Book Passage, and I'm here to do all the things that aren't interesting. For example, to tell you to please turn off your cell phone or put it on vibrate so that we won't be interrupting one another during the lecture. I just turned my own off. Dr. Brizendine and I were thinking a little while ago, well, maybe nobody will come because it's such a terrible rainy night, and I am so excited to see you all here. This is fabulous. I know that a lot of you have seen these slides, and we hope that you will come to all of the events that Book Passage and Dominican do together, and all of the events at this marvelous, beautiful campus. I just to remind you, in case you can't read, which I bet you can, on April 22nd is Earth Day, and Bill McKibben, one of the fathers of Earth Day, a man who talks to Al Gore several times a week, is coming with his new book, Earth. And for some reason, he spells it E-A-A-R-T-H, which drives me crazy, but I'm sure he'll explain it. We just got word a couple of weeks ago that Craig Robinson, Michelle Obama's brother and the coach of the Oregon State basketball team, will be here on April 27th for his book, Game of Character, talking about, remember, community organizing? He's going to talk about that and what we can do. And if you remember the Democratic Convention, you probably remember him introducing his sister and all of his charm. We're going to hold that one, I think quite appropriately, in the basketball arena. And then on April 28th, we have a very busy April. On April 28th, Michael Chabon will be here in conversation with Michael Krasny to talk about his book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. This is the culmination of our One Book, One Marin that Dominican and the Marin Education Fund and Book Passage and the libraries and all kinds of community groups and book clubs all over the county join together. And we hope you'll come because it's going to be great. And just thank you for supporting Dominican and independent book selling and all of these authors. I know you're going to want Luann's book tonight. After the event, we're going to line up on your left, my right. There's also going to be a table of Book Passage booksellers because we never want to miss a sale. Because after you hear Luann, you're going to want a huge stack of books for everybody you know, especially all the guys you know. And Luann will personalize. She will put your name in it, so the ushers and staff will help you get that all ready. And if you decide to buy something while you're in line, I personally promise you, you can have your place back. So I'm going to turn this over to the wonderful Dr. Denise Lucy, one of the deans here at Dominican and the head of the Institute for Leadership Studies, a person who I treasure because we work together on so many things, and these events would not be happening without her amazing... I just have to tell you, whenever I say, hey, how about this event? She says, sure, how can we make it happen? And I love it. So, Denise, thank you.
Elaine is president of my fan club. I love her dearly. But I know that many of you have been here before, and we want to welcome you again to the fabulous leadership lecture series that we offer together with Book Passage and our terrific sponsor, the Marin Magazine. And I also wanted to thank tonight our very wonderful partner in our many community projects, actually, the Marin Women's Commission. Commissioners, thank you so much for being here tonight and for supporting this evening. Could we please thank the Women's Commission for also supporting this? Now, I just to do a couple of housekeeping things, just to make sure that you are aware that when we offer these lectures, we do it as a way to extend to our community. Our students are in the house tonight. Our psychology majors, are you here? Our counseling psychology, let's hear it. Yes, and our science majors. And your revered faculty who have encouraged you to join us this evening and to invite our neighbors to come to talk about important ideas about leadership, about how the world has changed, both individually, organizationally, and in society around important ideas. And we have a great speaker tonight who's going to do that for us. Her work is renowned, and she certainly fits within the great list of speakers we've had before, some of whom are people like Vice President Al Gore, Isabel Allende, Susie Orman, Bill Bradley, a whole cast, Paul Hawken, Daniel Goleman, great, great people in multiple different disciplines. So thank you all for coming. I wanted to introduce my very dear colleague and friend, Dr. Martha Nelson, who is the Dean of the School of Health and Natural Sciences, who will introduce Dr. Brizendine. Dr. Nelson?
Thank you, Denise. It's my honor to introduce our special guest tonight. She is a distinguished Marin resident. She lives just down the road in Sausalito. Dr. Luann Brizendine graduated from Yale Medical School, and she completed her internship and residency at Harvard. She is board certified in psychiatry and neurology, and she is an endowed clinical professor at the University of California in San Francisco. In 1994, she founded the UCSF Women and Teens Mood and Hormone Clinic and continues, it's Women and Teens Mood and Hormone Clinic, and she continues to serve as its director. And this was the first of this kind of clinic to study gender differences in the brain and the behavior and hormones in the country. She then decided, in 2006, her first book, The Female Brain, earned high praise from readers and from critics, and it climbed the New York Times bestseller list. Then she decided to take a look at the other half of the human species, and she studied the male brain. In her new book, The Male Brain, A Breakthrough Understanding of How Men and Boys Think, Dr. Brizendine integrates the latest scientific research with observations from her clinical practice, and she puts this in a format that is reader-friendly. If The Female Brain was a must-read for all women and for the men who love them, then The Male Brain is for men and the women who are doing their best to love and understand them. So the time has come now for Dr. Brizendine to tell you about the book herself. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Brizendine.
Is this on? Great, thank you. Thank you all for coming tonight. I'm going to stand out here where I can actually see you, and I don't have to stand exactly in the lights for this. But tonight, I'm very happy to be here to talk with you about my new book, The Male Brain. Just so I get an idea of the audience tonight, how many of you had read parts of The Female Brain, or at least of the other half? Okay, great. So a lot of you have, you know that the style is not too hard to read. When you put the word brain in a title, I think it sometimes scares people away. They think it's going to be too hard to read. So those of you that have read it know that it's told through stories, and so anybody can read it, whether they've had any science or not. You know, when I was in medical school, I remember one day sitting in class, and this is in the 1970s, and my professor was explaining a study, and I found it very, very interesting, and so I raised my hand and I said, you know, what were the sex differences in the study? He replied, oh, well, we don't study the sex differences, it would mess up the data. And sad to say, but I was such a scientist in that those days, I thought, oh, of course, you wouldn't want to mess up the data. So, but over the years, I've contemplated that experience, and, you know, we haven't really studied that much about sex differences in the brain until recent years, in the past decade or so, when we've had sophisticated technology in terms of MRI scans and other types of ways to study the brain, where we can actually look at the differences between male and female brain. And up until this last decade or so, we have basically thought that there was a unisex brain. Scientists now know there is no unisex brain, but all of you in this audience probably already knew that. At any rate, up until, now this is in the 1970s and 80s, and you know, up until recently, all medical research was done with males. And even the birth control pill was studied first on males. So medical research, and that's not for any nefarious reason whatsoever, it's mostly because, well, first of all, you wouldn't want to mess up the data, right? But on the other hand, it's very difficult in research to study females who are especially a young age and might be pregnant and you don't want to injure the fetus. So I think, you know, for various kinds of reasons, we didn't know for many years what the effect of some drugs are on females, but now it's mandated at the NIH that you must study both males and females, even if you're studying just about anything, unless you say, I'm studying testicles. And then you're allowed to use only males, or you're studying ovaries, and then you're allowed to study only the females. So what we do know now is that, well, we got our cell phones off, I'm sure, already. in the fetal life, so let's go back to the very beginning. And at conception, you know that we all start off with what's called female-type brain circuits. And nature's default pattern is female until 8 weeks of gestation, when the tiny testicles start to produce huge amounts of testosterone that marinates the brain, changing the circuits into male brain circuits, so that by the time we're all born, we are either born with a male brain or a female brain. And that does things like marinate and fertilize areas like the area for sexual pursuit in the male brain, which is deep in the hypothalamus of the male brain, and it grows to be 2.5 times larger in the male brain than in the female brain. And in rats, actually, the male brains have 7.0 times larger than the female. So in lots of mammals, that's the role and the job of the male, is to sexually pursue the female of all the species, because that's how you get procreation and the survival of our species. So, at any rate, let's take a look a little deeper. If we were able to saw off the skull and the brain, take a little bit of a look down inside here, I want to show you if we can see these little green areas. You all see the green areas there? Those are the areas that are more active in the male brain, and the reddish rose-colored pink ones are the ones that are more active in the female brain. Now, you know, we talked about that area for sexual pursuit being larger in the male. You can see that green area right there, which is 2.5 times larger in the male brain than the female. And all of these areas have been studied to be more active in one sex than the other. Now, if we took a look a little bit deeper, and let's start with the female brain, shall we? And I know Dr. Ghosh is going to particularly like this piece of the work down here in the front row. So this is one of your science professors here. This next slide will help you look a little deeper into the female brain. I particularly like the need for commitment hemisphere. Can those of you over on this side see? And I like the chocolate center. That's one of my favorites, is the big chocolate center up there. And then the indecision nucleus, of course. Jealousy, listening. And one of my favorites is the shoe and handbag coordination center. You see that part right up there? I like that one. Telephone skills, shopping, listening. And you see that little area for sex, and it says, see the note below. So those of you in the back, I'm going to read the footnote for you. It says, footnote. Note how closely connected the small sex cell is to the listening gland. So what do you all suppose is in that big fat area right in the center in the male brain? Somebody there already knows. Somebody knows. So for those of you over there, you see the crotch scanning area, like the crotch scanning area, the toilet aiming cell, domestic skills. I like that tiny dot that says ironing. I don't think my son even knows what an iron is. I particularly like this section over here for those of you that says, avoid personal questions at all costs. And the footnote on this one says, listening to children cry in the middle of the night gland is not shown due to its small and underdeveloped nature. It says best viewed under a microscope. I'll show you why that is and isn't true a little bit later, but that was the... So now that you know all about the male brain and the female brain, I wanted to tell you a little story about sort of the origins of how I got interested in this field. I was undergraduate at UC Berkeley in the 1970s, and I was lucky enough as an undergraduate to be the first graduating class, actually, to get an undergraduate degree in neurobiology. And I got to study under some of the greats like Frank Beach and Miriam Diamond. And Miriam Diamond actually is still alive and teaching at UC Berkeley. But remember, this is when I was 19, 20 years old, and it's the 1970s, and I was very much a part of the feminist movement. And for those of you wondering, yes, I did burn a few bras, not my own, but somebody else's. A lot of us women said, you know, when we have our own boys, we are going to give them gender-neutral toys. We're going to raise these boys to be sensitive guys, and our future daughters-in-law will thank us for raising such sensitive husbands for them. Weren't we cocky? However, this changed when we all had our own sons. And I can remember thinking how brave I was to give my son gender-neutral toys. And one Christmas, I got him not only the action figure that he was asking for, I got him a Barbie doll. And he rips open the box, pulls her out by the torso, and uses those long legs as a spear, fighting off imaginary enemies. So I thought I'd bring for you tonight and show you what his favorite toy that year was, or at least a facsimile of that. This was... Does this look like the four-year-old boy? This definitely was one of the many action figures. I think we still have them somewhere up on the shelf, and my step-grandson is visiting now. I think he's having a heyday with them. At any rate, nobody teaches boys and girls how to act like a boy or girl. The rough and tumble play of boys is well known even throughout all the animal kingdom. And of course, little girls and little boys do lots of things similarly, but I wanted to bring you a couple. Like, Here's the little girls talking to each other. Little girls do relationship type play often. They will give you role assignments, like you be the daddy and I'll be the mommy, or you be the doctor, I'll be the patient. So that's, little boys will do that as well, but they're quickly bored with that and they're often running to something else. And little boys, you know, they like making sure you strangle your little brother. And at any rate, I think it goes back to the girls and boys do lots and lots of things similarly, but they do a lot of things differently that we don't teach them how to do. Although culture does play a lot into building how we do gender behavior over our lives. These two characters, do they look familiar to anybody? They look like they're up to no good. I'd like to see what's on that computer screen, wouldn't you? The reason I thought this was cute was this happens to be at the age where boys 9, 10, 11 start to have what we women and mothers refer to as that boy smell. Anybody in the audience? Any women in the audience transport a lot of boys this age in the back of their car? What do you immediately do as soon as they pile in? Down with the windows, exactly. Now, interestingly enough, that boy smell, it's not BO quite yet. It's definitely can be stinky socks, but it smells more acrid. And that is the beginning of their sweat glands releasing androstenedione or various kinds of androgens that females are still able to smell. But actually, at puberty, boys stop being able to smell that at some point. But it's an indication that his testicles have started pumping out testosterone. And I think one of the most remarkable things that I talk about in the book is that this ramping up of testosterone from age 9 years old to 15 increases 20-fold. It would be like at age 9 drinking a cup of beer, but by 15 you're drinking close to 2 gallons of the stuff. So certainly all of those circuits that were laid down in fetal life. And remember, the boys and girls go through something called the juvenile pause when there are very, very low hormones of testosterone and estrogen. Then they start to ramp up during these years of teen years. And the boys start a couple years later than the girls, of course. These hormones, particularly the testosterone, starts to run the circuitry, like that area for sexual pursuit or having, say, fantasies about girls' body parts starts to happen. And those of you who have read the book in the Teen Boy Brain chapter, I talk about sometimes boys that are 13 and 14 start having these thoughts. They kind of think they're pervs until they realize all the other guys are also thinking the same thing. It's a natural, normal part of starting one's masculinity and starting to search out the female at that stage. He'll also spend a fair amount of time in behind closed doors, and we mothers learn to keep our mouth shut, but he disappears into his own world. He may look a lot of his anatomy and be very worried whether he's adequate or not, and that will sort of probably remain. Probably women in the audience don't know that has actually been shown in a recent study of over 50,000 people. Men are 85% of males worry something about how their genitals appear. And yet, females are happy with their partner. I think men don't realize that most women are very happy with them, and some men, though, worry about aspects of that part of their anatomy, and it certainly starts that age. We women are always obsessed with that. That's nothing new to us, but we should know that guys have the same issue as well. Now, here is the other half of the equation, the teen girl half, and at this stage, their brains are becoming what? Quite obsessed with appearance, physical appearance, and becoming and being sexually attractive to boys. Hair, makeup, outfits, et cetera, fitting in with their peer groups. And you might note that all of these girls are wearing slightly, a couple of them, skimpy outfits. I can remember talking to my son as he hit the high school age when girls would wear very skimpy things to class, and he'd say, "Yeah, Mom, you know, it's really hard sometimes to take my eyes off of them." So the torture of teen boys in the classroom is something that's probably well known to some of you in this audience who teach teenagers. Now, what's going on in the female brain at this stage? Well, her brain is transitioning to making an 8-lane superhighway for processing emotions, while guys are having the small country road version of that. But you guys are busy building O'Hare Airport as a hub for processing thoughts about sex, while females have the airfield nearby that lands small and private planes. So that's what's happening in the teen years. You know, we get lots of remodeling going on, and this happens for boys up until age 21 or 22. Their brain is not completely finished, and girls finish at about age 19. So I think that this issue of having a lot of expectations that decisions are going to be carefully considered and thought out at a younger age is something that society needs to maybe bump the age up a little bit on some things. Boys a little bit longer than girls. Now, transitioning over to a stage where we get to the point where we've selected, shall we say, the one and only, the transition of the 20s and up to age 30 or so for boys, when they have chosen the woman they'd like to be with. And hopefully, you know, these things are so much in the news lately, you know, monogamy versus whatever, but committing to one woman and getting ready to start the next phase of life, the daddy brain phase. And I think that this phase was a phase I found in doing the research for this book the most surprising to me, because I was very interested to know that the pheromones released by the sweat glands of the pregnant partner wafted over into the male nostrils and stimulated his brain to make 30% more prolactin, which is a hormone that makes milk in females, of course, prolactin, prolactation. And yet, scientists still don't know what it's doing in the male. It also is causing his testosterone to go down by 30 to 35%. And scientists believe or hypothesize that that is an aspect of fatherhood to kind of keep him at home, and he's not out chasing every fertile, curvaceous female out in public at that point. He's going to stay at home and take care of the baby. The other thing that happens, interestingly, in the daddy brain is, you know, they've done brain scan studies and auditory testing and seen the auditory circuits in the male brain change from before his wife is pregnant till 9 months later. The change is that he is not able to hear babies cry as easily before, but by the time his baby is born, his hearing to hear infants cry has actually improved quite a lot. So that by the time his baby is born, a father is also ready to take charge of taking care of his child as well. So I found that after having written the mommy brain and done all the research with the female brain, thinking that was such a female aspect, to find how much biological attunement a dad or the daddy brain actually gets to is quite astounding to me. And of course, another aspect of being a daddy that I discovered in doing the research is, you know, dads don't behave the same towards their children or their babies when the mom is around. There's lots and lots of studies that show that what's called infant-parent synchrony, so that lovely kind of reciprocity you see here, doesn't develop as well if dads aren't allowed to spend some alone time with their babies. So there's a body of research that looks at mothers who are called sort of hyperactive, what are called gatekeepers, and they won't let anywhere near their baby or won't let the baby go with the dad without being around. So I would encourage moms to try and trust the dads a little more and let them spend some alone time with their babies. So that's some very interesting work, a lot of it done by Ruth Feldman for probably the last 25 or 30 years. She's done some, for those of you who are the psychology students in the audience, you might want to take a look at her work, her beautiful work. And this guy, obviously, is the new version of fatherhood, probably in Germany, because any of you know how long paternity leave is by legal statute in Germany? Anybody know? Actually, I heard someone say a couple of years. It's 14 months of paternity leave. Wow. I know. So I say that the German male is going to be the new model of fatherhood for the world. The German women always laugh at me because they still end up doing most of the housework. However, they do have a little phrase in Europe for Fridays. You know what they call the day Friday? They call Friday Daddy's Day. It's evidently lots of dads that do access some paternity leave take Friday off and they stay home with the kids on Fridays. The women still end up doing most of the housework, however. Not surprising. But at any rate, I love this photo because it kind of demonstrates how competent dads actually are if we would just give them a chance. Okay. Now, what's this guy doing? He's fixing something. And I wanted to give you, those of you that have a copy of the book in your hand, you see what's on the front cover is that brain built out of duct tape. And that's an homage to the fact that the male brain is, males fix things. And the search for quick solutions to things, I think, is an aspect of the male brain that I go into a lot in chapter 6 called the emotional life of men. The reason being is that males use some of the same circuits that we women do for emotional circuitry, of course, but they switch very quickly into a system called the TPJ system that allows them to sort of Google search their whole brain to come up the solution very quickly in an emotional situation. For example, how many of you women in the audience have brought a problem to the man in your life and said, honey, you know, it happened at work today, and so it was a little awful, and I'm just so upset about that, you know, what she did today, and she's always doing blah, 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 and, you know, the look on his, he immediately says, what does he say? He says, honey, you know what you should do? Anybody ever have that? The honey, I know what you should do phrase? That's because his brain has found a solution very quickly already, and he's actually trying to help you. It's actually a loving thing that he's doing. He's helping you. However, we women do not experience it that way because, take a look at this couple here. He's saying, but I'm only trying to help you. And she's saying, but you don't know how I feel. So, if I can teach one thing to the men in the audience today, and my husband will attest to this because I have a little yellow sticky that I put on his computer that says this, and we have a little running joke about it. But the men, if you could first say the following words to her before you launch into the solution. Honey, I know how you feel. And my husband, who's sitting in the front row here, I may be outing you a little bit, dear, but I'm going to tell a little story. Besides the yellow sticky on the computer that says, honey, I know how you feel, which he actually reads out loud, even though it's scripted, before he launches into the solution, like, I know what you should do, or you know what you should do, it actually makes me feel better and have a more open mind to hear what he has to say. But the story I'm going to tell you is he told me the other day, I didn't know this until recently, but he said, you know, I've actually used that with my daughter. And his daughter's in her 40s, and she and her father have a very, very close relationship, and they talk frequently on the phone. He says, you know, I've used that with her before I launch into telling her what to do, and it seems to be working really well. So, honey, thank you for sharing that story with me. I love that story. At any rate, okay, guys, try it out with your daughters and with your wife. The honey, I know how you feel statement. Okay, now I'm going to teach women something for you gals, because something that I learned through doing clinical work for the last 20 years. And here's a couple. I often have couples who come to my office. I get the phone call, and I know the phone call comes, and it says, Dr. Brissenden, you've got to see me. You've got to save my marriage. And then she'll say, you know, he says if I don't start having more sex or wanting sex, he's going to leave me, or he's going to have to find somebody else, or we're headed for divorce. You know, it's some version of that. And it's a crisis. And she said, if it were me, I wouldn't care, but he really cares a great deal. So I get them in my office, and I'll say to him, John, how do you know that Mary loves you? And he'll say, oh, because she wants to have sex with me. Mary's face is just stunned and I'll turn to her and say, Mary, how do you know that John loves you? And she says, well, because he wants to cuddle and talk with me. And his face at that point is stunned. I would say that the crux of the story is that the expression of love and feeling that a man is loved may come in a more sexual direction, perhaps, than it does for us women. And if that part of a man's life is not going well with his partner, it doesn't have to do necessarily with quantity of sex, but just that she wants him as a sexual partner means a lot to him. And so here is the take-home message for women. For those of you in the background who can't see this guy, he's crawling on his hands and knees towards the bed where she's reading a book. Maybe she's even reading The Male Brain, you know. And he's saying, sex, sex. So you don't want to end up with your bedroom looking like this is something I would say for the women in the audience, that it has a different meaning to males versus females. We females like to be wanted by our husbands as well in that way, but in terms of the love piece of that and the meaningfulness of men when it's not going well, I think is something for us to take deeply at heart. Now, there's a chapter in the book I can't really talk about much in public. It's chapter 4. It's called The Brain Below the Belt, that you can read in the privacy of your own home. But it may help women understand a little bit more about what's going on down there. And it's, yes, exactly. And maybe some men as well. So now we turn to the mature male brain. And I can see a lot of you in the audience, mature male brains. My husband has a mature male brain, and that's chapter 7 in the book. And I'm talking about the stage of life where males actually develop often a lot more patience. Their hormones, however, do not fall off a cliff like ours do. Our ovaries retire and we go with a plummeting estrogen. Men, however, do this. They do this little bit here. They start to go down at about between age 30 and 40, there starts to drop a little bit and drops over a long, long period of time. And we have a name for that in medicine called andropause. It means the androgens are decreasing. And it's a time the males never fall off a cliff in terms of their testosterone. And many males have enough testosterone to run their sexual pursuit and sexual interest circuits into their 70s, 80s, and 90s. So it doesn't necessarily mean they don't have any sexual interest. But the testosterone goes down a bit, their actual relative amount of estrogen goes up a bit. And what is it that estrogen produces a lot of us in us females? It stimulates the production of oxytocin. Anybody ever heard of oxytocin? It's not OxyContin, it's oxytocin. But it's called the love and cuddle hormone. It's actually the hormone that causes the uterus to contract and squeeze out the baby. It causes milk to squeeze out when you're breastfeeding. So it's an interesting hormone that's more plentiful in females, although males start to have more of it at this stage of life. Oxytocin, the cuddle hormone, we call it. So here's my version of the mature male brain, that men get a lot more cuddly, they get a lot more patient, they stand still a little bit more, and I think it's a wonderful time of life for men in the male brain. And so women who have hung around for a long time, ladies, you've got a lot of good years to look forward to. And I love this picture. I think this is a nice cuddly picture of the mature male brain. And of course, going into grandfather years, I know that around my household, my husband has had a big transition since he's had grandchildren. He's quite a sweet grandfather, and he has a lot more time and patience with his grandchildren than I think he did with his children. I think his daughters are quite amazed and delighted at the level of attention and interest that he pays to the grandchildren, and they actually are quite pleasantly surprised, dear. At any rate, I know lots of, how many of you are grandparents in the audience? Is that something that you all have found to be true, too, is that your patience and tolerance for all kinds of things, and little things that might have bothered you when you were a parent, no longer are worth even worrying about. So I think those years also of the grandfather brain are a lovely time of life. And as a matter of fact, listen, you grandpas might even learn a few eye-hand coordination skills from your grandson. I know that's what goes around in our house is the computer and video games. And he might even be quite a lot better than you at quite a young age. So at any rate, I want to thank you tonight for having me and being such a generous, generous audience. And I really wanted to allow some time for questions because I know a lot of you have read both The Female Brain, and some of you in the audience have had a little sneak preview of The Male Brain as well. And I really would love for any of you to have feedback. We're having an interesting discussion. My publisher had me go on to Facebook and start on my Facebook page a little discussion. So you can go on to that and ask me any questions also there. How many of you know about Facebook? I didn't know about it until a few years ago, but they have a lovely way that you can just have a discussion with the author there. It's very, very easy. So I know some of the young people in the audience probably live on their Facebook. So any of you, where are the psychology students tonight? Where are they? In the back? At any rate, please feel free to ask more questions as you read the book, and anything that pops into your mind, feel free to send a question to me. So at any rate, thank you very much for your attention and for all of your loyalty with The Female Brain and enjoying the male brain will be my deepest pleasure if it teaches you something and helps you understand and love the men in your life more. Thank you very much. I think they're providing some microphones for anybody that would like to ask a question. And I encourage you to use them so everybody can hear them, or I will also be happy to repeat any questions that any of you would like to ask. And don't be shy.
Hi there, over here on your left.
Oh, hi. Hi, tell us your first name, please.
Barbara.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Do you think there is a difference in the development of a male brain or a man's brain as it relates to relating to women if they have remained single, unmarried, as adults in their 50s and 60s versus a male brain of someone who has had one marriage or more?
Well, I think men learn to put up with us after a lot of years together. And so, you know, maybe he never just found the one, right? And maybe he's been waiting to find that woman that has the combination of things that meshes well with his own. I know that, you know, having had lots of patients in my office and having had experiences myself with men who have either not had relationships for a long time, sometimes they can come fresher to the experience. So, but they often need a little training, I hate to tell you, but, you know, it's like, and my husband and I joke about that as well, too, since, you know, no matter who you get together with, you have to train each other, and you have to know where you can't step on their toes. You have to know what the hot buttons are that you just agree to let rest, and what issues you're going to take on. So I think it's a getting used to each other. I think understanding a little bit how men look at a situation, and for them understanding how we look at a situation. I had a letter from an 80-year-old man the other day, said, Dr. Brizendine, you know, I read The Female Brain. I just want to thank you for writing it. I wish I'd had it when I was a younger man. It would have helped me avoid many mistakes in my life. So I think both of us need to kind of learn to forgive and give a little bit. Thanks for the question, Barbara. Let's see where else we have somebody. Judith, I would guess. Is that right? My swimming club from the Mill Valley Club, for the Mill Valley Community Center is here,
yes,
right?
Right here.
I also was a feminist in the 70s and really began to believe that gender was a social construction, as you mentioned. So the book which I read last night really flies in the face of all my mental constructs, and I wonder if you have any comment about that.
Yeah, did you all hear that question about how gender is, you know, the issue about gender being socially created versus being biological and hormonal? Of course, I come down a bit more on the biological side, obviously, but I now believe, having come full circle and sort of studied biology for many years, and really believing in the way, you know, the nature-nurture debate in a lot of ways, I think, is dead at this point for the following reason. The brain is very, very malleable. You know, we're all born with male or female predispositions, and then we'll have the hormones that increase that circuitry for behavior, which is what a hormone is supposed to do. A hormone's job is to make us predisposed to certain behaviors. However, the way we're raised, for example, you know, little boys, studies have shown that little boys who are told they're not supposed to touch something, they often will grab it and touch it, whereas a little girl can be given a verbal demand not to touch it. Little boys worldwide are punished more frequently for transgressions. Little boys are told not to cry. Little boys are told that they are supposed to man up, right? Even at a young age, dads sometimes are very, very scared if their little boy is making any version of effeminate behaviors. For example, I remember flying coast to coast with a guy sat next to me, and he said, you know, his 18-year-old son, when he saw his sister open a present earlier that week that was a purse. She'd gotten a purse. She was 4 years old. And he said, oh, can I have a purse too? And he said he found himself like someone had kicked him in the stomach, and he just yelled at his 18-year-old son. He says, no, boys don't have purses. And he was reporting to me this event, and he felt so ashamed and embarrassed afterwards because he realized the little boy wasn't expressing anything in terms of being effeminate or not. So these things, the way we raise little boys and the way we raise little girls, our brain circuits are so malleable. For example, we weren't born learning to play the piano, right? You do practice, practice, practice. You can retrain brain circuits to do a variety of things. And I think all of our life we are trained, we can be gender trained to be more one way or the other. Males' facial expressions, for example, when they measure them and put electrodes on them, which they have done, and show them a grisly photograph that's supposed to make you cringe and emotional, their facial expressions versus females actually show more emotional response in the time before it becomes conscious. And right after the 1 second level when it becomes conscious, they start to freeze down their facial muscles for frowning or smiling. Females' facial muscles actually amplify and the males go down. Scientists believe that the hypothesis is that males have been trained to suppress their emotional feelings. So thanks for the question. It's a moving target for a lot of our lives and the ways we're raised and what we're allowed to do, what boys are allowed and what boys are not allowed to do has a lot to do with how they grow up to be men. So thanks. Sorry for the long-winded description of that, but you asked me one of my hot questions. Yes, next to Judith.
My name is Ralph.
Hi,
Ralph.
Are
there studies of gender differences in brains, facial expressions, hormones, and so forth in particular groups where we might expect the men had higher than average emotional competence? For example, psychotherapists, spiritual directors, energy healers,
yes,
or indeed women who've had assertiveness training and men who've had sensitivity training.
So I hope you all heard that question, and it's about basically how individual people are. And if you looked at, for example, if you looked at the bell-shaped curve for men on issues of emotionality and the bell-shaped curve for women on issues of emotionality, you'll look down at the bottom and there's about a 10% overlap. Just as lots of women are taller than men, there's a huge variety of individuals. When we talk about sex differences, you're looking at the flagpole at the top of that bell-shaped curve for the males and females, and you're measuring the distance between those two. So that we talk about sort of the average or the typical difference between male and female. But lots of individual males, I think males that are psychotherapists and are, you know, you guys are on the end of a spectrum that's just individually and personality-wise more interested in emotions and more emotional circuitry. So thanks for that question. It's a very individual issue. And some women are less interested in emotions and maybe on the callous end of things as well. So when you talk about the average or typical, that sometimes runs over the issue of the individual. So thank you very much for that question. Let's see, we've got lots of people in the middle here.
Hi, Luanne.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
How are you doing? Say your first
Stephen.
Name first of all.
Stephen. This may be your next book, but could you say something about the gay brain?
Okay. So you may turn straight to Appendix 1 that's called The Male Brain and Sexual Orientation, where I fought with my editors and publisher to allow me to put that section in the book because I felt it needed to be there. If you're going to have a book called The Male Brain, you need to include at least something about all sexual orientations. Now, I'm basically, the literature in science seems to indicate at this point that genetic differences at birth are probably responsible for what's called same-sex attraction. It's not some kind of a moral decision. It's not something that happens to you that changes you. It has to do probably with some type of brain circuitry that happens because of both genes and some hormones. For example, you know, when teen boys that are straight start to go through puberty, they start to be attracted to female body shapes. They may see everything that walks by that looks like a pair of breasts. Straight guys are interested in, but at the same time, guys that are same-sex attracted are interested in guys. As a matter of fact, one very interesting study showed that males who are gay actually find they don't change their ability to smell male pheromones. They continue to be able to smell male pheromones and actually enjoy that smell much more than the female pheromone smells, which the straight guys like. So there's something that's going on at a very biological level. So thank you for that question. We need a lot more research before we're able to say much more definitive about that area. But thank you.
I have heard that the male brain has...
Your first name again?
Oh, my name is Gary.
Oh, Dr. Gary, Resendin. Thank you, okay.
I have heard that the male brain has a emotional processing center on one hemisphere, while female brains have emotional processors on both sides. Of course, this probably goes back to, you know, you gotta have, if you're looking at a saber tooth, it's good to have the side running that doesn't have the emotional processor.
You don't wanna think too much about running away from a tiger, right?
Yeah, you may not live with that one. I'd like to hear more about that because I've just heard about that recently in a lecture and how that affects male-female communication. And men's ability to really function emotionally, it was kind of a shock to find out I was born with, you know, one sign that didn't have that.
It's a great question, so I'll repeat that. He's heard that males tend to use one side of their brain instead of the two sides that the females use. And I think it's important to say that male and female brains, of course, are more alike than they are different. After all, we are the same species, right? So What we do know in lots of areas of looking at what side, which hemisphere of the brain males versus females use, it seems to be pretty consistently that males will use one side of the brain to do a problem or to sense an emotion, and females are lighting up in the brain scans both sides, both hemispheres. We don't quite know exactly why that is, and it doesn't necessarily make one sex better than the other. I mean, as a matter of fact, it may make men more focused, and they don't get so much chatter from the two sides. That may make it easier for them to just charge forward and do whatever needs to be done, like you say. We don't know for sure. There are many hypotheses. So I wouldn't really say that. I think that I heard a little bit of your feeling that meant that you're not sort of using as much gray matter. Of course, you have 10% larger brain than we have. That should be reassuring. The male brain is 10% larger. We females have, you know, as many cells, but they're just corseted down in a smaller skull. So that's reassuring to the females. But I think which side of the brain you use, whether you use both sides, yes, it is a gender difference that's been repeatedly seen by scientists. We don't necessarily know the meaning of it, and it doesn't make one better or worse. Okay, thanks for the question. We have another one over here on this side. I have to give the poor people in the back a little...
Hi,
how are
Anna.
You?
Good,
your name is Tanya. Hi,
Anna.
Tanya.
Anna.
Anna, thank
yes.
you.
What's the difference in the brain of a male who's been raised by a single mom without a supportive father? And also, why is it that it seems like either they embrace femininity or they reject it and end up abusing women?
Did you all hear that question? It's about boys who are raised without a dad, right, dad in the family, and raised, say, by single moms, and... Having been a single mom up till my son was about 6 years old as well, I can certainly relate to that it's not very easy to do that, and it's really not great. My son has had a lot of help over the years by male teachers. Male teachers have been very important in his life. So I guess what I would say to that issue is that children need both a male and a female model in their life. And actually, studies have shown that kids who are raised with an interactive father do end up doing better academically over their life. So I think single moms would, you know, need a lot of extra help, and they need a lot of extra male supporters around that are going to interact with that child, that son, to help him see some different versions of manhood. I think what you're saying is sometimes boys will grow up to be very respectful of females, and some of them will be very angry at their mother for not having had a man in their life. So I think it's very individually variable on what the personality of the boy happens to be, how he's going to grow up, and how the mother is able to pull in extra male support. So I hope that partially answers your question. Complex issue, though. Thank you for that question, Anna. Let's see. Got somebody in the back here.
Good evening.
Hi, your name?
My name is Cynthia.
Hi, Cynthia.
And I am in a business where I work with couples, and I'd like to ask you a question. Women love to dance, and men run out the door.
Women love to dance in your office, and then
the men run out
the door?
No, I teach people how to dance, and I have the women all wanting to come, and they drag their boyfriends, husbands,
right. Okay.
And there's a lot of reluctance.
Yeah.
And does that have anything to do with their brains?
Don't you think a lot of men like to dance too? How many men in the audience love to dance? I bet there's a lot of guys here who love to dance. You know, it may be something to do with the sociology of having a woman just want to go do something, and then she's dragging him to do it, and he's probably resenting doing it. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, how many guys do you know that like it when a woman turns to them and says, honey, I think we need to have a long discussion about our relationship. The guy heads for the door then too, doesn't he? Or pretty quick he has something he must do in the garage. Thanks, Cynthia, for that question. And I can take a couple more. Let's see, oh, we got one way in the back. Can we get this young lady way in the back in the third row? I hate to leave the people in the back out who are the college psychology students are sitting back in the back row here.
Hi, my name's Sandra.
Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I have to preface this actually first by asking if I can ask a question about the female brain.
Of course.
Physiologically, does something change in the brain when you're pregnant that makes you less intelligent?
How many women in the audience have ever been pregnant? Okay, so you have a show of hands. How many of the women feel like the hormones of pregnancy did in some ways affect their brain, or at least the postpartum state? I think that what happens in the female brain in the hormonal stimulation of pregnancy doesn't necessarily make you smarter or stupid or anything like that. But what it does do is kind of reassigns and reallocates resources in the brain. And the thinking these days is that what it actually does is it stimulates the brain to pay hyper attention to the infant. And of course, for, you know, evolutionarily speaking, the female role has been the most important thing that she can do is have a healthy pregnancy and be able to keep a helpless infant alive. So her brain circuits during the mommy brain are really alerted to trying to do everything she can do and focusing her attention. Remember, all of our attentional resources are limited. We'd like to be able to pay attention to everything, right? That's why they say you shouldn't drive while you're using your cell phone, because you need to have attention. So the attentional resources are reallocated during the formation of the mommy brain and postpartum. I think she's becoming very much smarter about taking care of the infant, which means that other things have less priority. I hope that helps how we're thinking about that. Okay, I've got another question in the back here. Do we have a microphone for this lady? I guess the balcony, you guys, sorry to say you didn't get a microphone up there, but I'll be down in the front afterwards and be happy to talk to you. Yes?
Have you discovered...
Your name, please?
Stacy.
Hi, Stacy.
Hi. Have you discovered a difference in the male brain as far as auditory functioning and, you know, the ability to hear directions?
Did you all hear that question? She wants to know if there's a difference in hearing hearing directions in the male brain. Well, again, I would go back to the principle of allocation of attentional resources. He may be focusing on something other than what you're asking or what the directions are. He may be focusing on other things. And so it may seem as if his hearing is decreased. However, he may be just allocating resources to something else that you don't know what he's thinking about, and he may not tell you. So thanks for that question. Okay, I think we have time for two more, right? This gentleman in the front row. Hi.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Randy.
Randy. How are you?
Good. What happens to the brain when we are in love?
Oh, the love circuits, yes. Well, did you read the Love and Lust chapter already? Is that what you read? Okay, you're cheating. Anyway, so, you know, I think something about the love circuits that's fascinating is that scientists believe that love circuits actually in the brain are hijacked circuits for maternal love for the infant. Have you heard that? And the love circuits, of course, anything that we take pleasure in and get rewarded over and over again, dopamine in the brain hits the reward circuits and makes us want to do that thing. And if someone is giving us great pleasure sexually and emotionally, the love circuits start firing away in the brain, and pretty soon, you know, nobody else will do. She's just the one. That's the only person you want to think about, spend time with. You know, all of the way she moves, the way she smells, the way she dresses, all of her activities become part of yours. We even call it sort of an expansion of the identity of the self to include in your envelope of your identification of yourself, the other, the beloved. So you know how almost like you start thinking about everything that would please them, and you start thinking, oh, you know, that becomes almost as important as pleasing yourself. So the expansion in the brain of the identity of the self to include in that envelope the beloved other, those are your love circuits. So I hope that helps you understand what's going on there. Okay, one last one. We've got, let's see, a lady right here in the middle. She's been, okay, we've got one on this side. I can't let this side go here. Hi. Hi.
My name is Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Good. I have a two-part question.
Sure.
I'm curious if the research that you drew from for your book was all done in the States. And also, when you were talking about men getting older and becoming more sensitive, So for men who from a fairly young age have more capacity for feeling and emotional bandwidth, do you think that their brains are any different, or do you think that that's just the effect of environment?
So let's see, which question first? We'll talk about, so for those of you who have your hands on the book itself, you'll notice that there are 1,400 plus references in the book, and those were worldwide studies in neuroscience that had to do with the male brain, or the differences between the male and the female brain. And going to your question about older men versus younger men, you know, it's again an issue of what you have to pay attention to. A younger man has the issue of trying to find the one, procreating with the one, supporting the household, supporting the family, supporting children, becoming the daddy brain. I mean, he also has a lot on his plate. So it's hard to say that's a different sort of environmental situation than the older dads who decide to become dads when they're already financially secure, or the older, mature male brain who has a little bit more leisure and a little bit less sort of frantically trying to make a living. So there's an environmental piece of that. There's also a hormonal piece of that. Just like at every stage of a man's life, there's a different environmental piece and a different hormonal piece. Same for females in the stages of our lives. Think about how we were when we were teen girls versus in our 20s, and how those stages of our life both had a hormonal aspect, biological aspect of that, as well as an environmental aspect. So I think we have to honor that both of those really impact who we are, impact who we behave, impact what we think about, and who we love, and how we love. So thank you all very much for your attention tonight. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Lou Ann Brizendine on radio.dominican.edu. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It was fabulous. Thank you, Lou Ann. And Dr. Brizendine, you are a wise and amazing woman. We, as I mentioned before, we're going to sign books from this side. The folks
and that will do it for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening to radio.dominican.edu.